Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3085, United States of America versus Carl I. Coleman, appellant. Ms. Davis for the appellant, Mr. Hooks for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Davis. I represent the appellant, Mr. Coleman. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case involved a complex conspiracy that spanned approximately 8 years, resulting in losses exceeding $1.6 million. Mr. Coleman's involvement in this conspiracy was limited to approximately cashing 12 checks, counterfeit checks, that resulted in losses just over $55,000. His involvement in the conspiracy spanned approximately 3.5 months. Mr. Coleman entered a plea of guilty to conspiracy, and at the time of sentencing, it was argued on his behalf that he should only be held responsible for the $55,000 figure and not for anything more, because anything else was beyond the scope of his agreement of the conspiracy, and it was not foreseeable. At the time of sentencing, the judge considered, and the pre-sentence report writer considered, and the government considered only foreseeability, and there is never any finding regarding the scope of the agreement. And according to the law in this circuit, and according to the guidelines, the court must first make a determination regarding scope of the agreement.
I thought your argument was really contesting the foreseeability, however. I didn't see at the sentencing hearing any suggestion, judge, you need to make a finding as to scope.
I think it was raised in the sentencing memorandum, scope and foreseeability.
Well, it certainly blends the two concepts at best. It says there's no evidence that the conduct of the others was foreseeable to him. And then the judge at the sentencing hearing says it is, because the defendant gave the license and Social Security information to open the account in his name, right?
Right, yes.
So on top, you said the only involvement was the check cashing. Actually, the other involvement was identifying information to Glay so that he could open a...
Exactly. He did give that. He gave the information to Mr. Glay. There was no evidence in either the plea agreement or at the sentencing hearing that Mr. Coleman knew that the account was actually opened or that it was used.
Well, but he knew. Why was he giving the information to him?
I don't know. There is no evidence. I mean, it is the government's burden to establish knowledge, and it's the government's
burden. Well, it's in the statement of offense. It's described.
That he gave the that he did give it, yes, but there's no evidence that he knew it was used. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly no evidence that he knew to the extent it was used. In fact, at the time of sentencing, even the government couldn't say to the extent that account was used.
Which account are you talking about?
The account opened in Coleman's name by Mr.
Coleman's Clay. Name. What about the account opened in Sherry Matthews?
There's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Coleman was aware of that account being opened. And there was no evidence. In fact, the government couldn't even say, again, at the time of sentencing, to what extent the checks that Mr. Coleman was ultimately held responsible for, the government could not say what checks went through Coleman's account and what checks went through the Matthews account.
And I was surprised in reading the hearing that that wasn't raised. In other words, counsel didn't say, we don't even know, judge, what money went into the Coleman account and what money went into the Matthews account. That was never said.
Well, the argument, I think, of counsel at sentencing was that there was no evidence that Mr. Coleman knew any of this. And I don't think it was necessary in order to preserve the issue. I don't think it was necessary for counsel to argue any specific points.
Well, you could have said even if Coleman's responsible for the Coleman account, Coleman certainly should not be responsible for the Matthews account. And that wasn't said. It seemed to be an assumption on the part of everyone at the sentencing hearing that the Coleman and Matthews accounts rose or fell together.
Well, you did argue the $55,000, right?
Right. It was argued that he's only responsible
for
the Coleman account.
Right. No, that's the
$55,000 was just the checks that were cashed by Mr. Coleman that didn't have anything to do with either the Coleman account or the Matthews account.
Ah.
Right. There's the $55,000. Let me just make sure I have it correct. There's $55,000 for the check cashing.
Exactly.
Okay, and on top of that, there's a Coleman account and a Matthews account.
Right.
Okay, and everyone agreed that the $55,000
was, yes.
Okay, and then on top of that, there was a question as to the two accounts.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And on the two accounts, my understanding from reading the sentencing hearing was that there really wasn't an argument of, okay, you can count one but not the other. It was really you count both or neither.
Right, because I think the argument was it what didn't even go as far as the accounts, because what the government was arguing is that Mr. Coleman should be responsible for these additional checks, not because of the accounts, but because of the victims. There was they were the same victims, like Sport and Health Club or whatever the companies were. That's why he was being held responsible for those additional amounts, not so much because of the accounts. I don't think that was
right,
so much of the issue.
Just to clarify the accounts, the $55,000 was the checks cashed.
By Mr. Coleman.
And the $155,000 or $146,000, what was that?
Those were checks that were cashed by other conspirators.
Did they washed through Coleman's account?
No one knows if they were through Coleman's account or Matthew's
account. Well, how are they, the overall, according to the indictment, the overall figures is 1.6 million.
Exactly.
So what differentiated the 155,000 from the other 90%?
Because those were checks, for instance, Mr. Coleman cashed counterfeit checks from companies A, B, C, and D. So what they did at sentencing is that if other conspirators cashed counterfeit checks from companies A, B, C, and D, then Mr. Coleman was held responsible for those checks as well.
So that's all checks drawn
from companies that Mr. Coleman cashed counterfeit checks for.
I see.
I don't know offhand. I don't know, and I don't know if it was ever really laid out, if there were additional checks that did not go through those accounts from those companies or not. I don't.
And the 11,000 adjustment had to do with the timing, right?
That was because Mr. Coleman came into the conspiracy after those checks were cashed. And so basically our argument is that, you know, there was no finding of scope, there was a requirement. And even though there was not a whole lot of argument, it was raised in the sentencing memorandum that it was neither within the scope nor was it foreseeable. And the law in this circuit makes it very clear that there has to first be a finding of scope. And as a matter of law, if there's no finding of scope, then the sentence has to be vacated and the case remanded back to the district court. And because the restitution amount was based on the sentencing guideline amount, then the restitution amount is also erroneous.
So the point you're assuming there's foreseeability that you're saying there still needs to be findings regarding the scope of the agreement.
Exactly.
To support what? The sentence under the guidelines?
Right. In order for the sentencing guideline calculation to be correct, there first has to be a finding of scope, then a finding of foreseeability. In this case, the judge based the restitution amount on the sentencing guideline calculation of loss. If the sentencing guideline calculation of loss is incorrect, well then the judge is erred in what he intended to do as far as the restitution amount.
On the scope point, I understood that to be that you shouldn't be responsible for the full 1.6 million over the 8 years, and and everyone agreed on that, including the judge saying, "No, you're not responsible for the whole 1.6 million. You're only responsible for the part of your involvement in the agreement. What's reasonably foreseeable to you?"
Right, but there was
your scope argument. I think would have your scope argument would have some more weight if the judge had said you're responsible for the whole 1.6 million.
I sure respectfully disagree.
You
there has to
that.
Be a finding of scope. There, I mean, that's the first thing the judge has to do is find scope. And whether he found scope to be 1.6 or 150,000, he still has to find scope. And the word wasn't even mentioned.
Why can't the scope be determined from the factual proffer than plea colloquy?
Because I don't see how the plea agreement determines what his scope was. It may have determined what he later found out to be the case, and he agreed. I mean, people agree to certain facts and plea agreements, but they're not part of that agreement that those facts came to be.
But the facts included a description of the conspiratorial agreement, right? So why doesn't that suffice?
I don't think the facts determined the conspiratorial agreement. The facts determined what the conspiracy overall involved, or what the conspiracy in part involved, but that doesn't determine the scope. And again, I think the case law in the circuit mandates the judge has to find scope. I mean, he can't just infer it. There has to be an actual finding of scope, and there was never even a mention of the word of scope by the judge at the time of sentencing. And unless
I don't know that we're dependent upon the magic word showing up. I don't know that we depend upon the magic word showing up if the record indicates that he determined the scope of the defendant's liability.
I think the law in the circuit is that there has to be a finding of scope by the judge. I don't think it can be inferred from the record. I think there has to be an actual finding by the judge.
I'm saying if it was inferred by the judge at the sentencing.
Oh, excuse me.
And where did the defense tell the judge that?
Tell the judge.
That you have to make a finding as to scope?
The argument was in the sentencing memorandum that
it's really not
there. It was beyond the scope. Excuse me?
Where is that?
While counsel for the government argues, I can find it, but.
And the only thing I see referencing scope, nor are there any facts on which to conclude that the scope of this defendant's agreement extended to the activity of the others over an 8-year period. Well, everyone ended up agreeing on that. Everyone agreed that you weren't going to be responsible for the full 8 years.
Right, but the additional amounts that he was found responsible for were acts by other conspirators, not by Mr. Coleman. So.
Depositing money into an account that was opened in his name after he had given identifying information to Galay.
Well, then that would go to knowledge and foreseeability. Again, there was no knowledge.
Right, and that was the disputed issue, I thought.
Well, I think you're right.
You've used your time, but we'll give you a minute on rebuttal, and if you could tell us the best indication in the record in support of your point that this objection was raised.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jonathan Hooks on behalf of the United States. The court's restitution order in this case was governed by the statute, the MVRA, not the sentencing guidelines, and the statute simply does not impose a requirement that the court make specific findings of fact. In drafting the MVRA, Congress chose not to require factual findings despite the other mandatory parts of the statute, the mandatory requirements it imposed, and gave the district court procedural discretion in terms of assessing that restitution amount. And this is different.
But he used that discretion to gear the amount to the sentencing guidelines calculation. If the sentencing guidelines calculation was erroneous or defective, then doesn't that undermine the reasoning leading to the dollar amount chosen under the Act?
Well, I think that there are two issues. There's the question of whether there was a substantive error in the calculation and whether the district court was procedurally required to make findings of fact. And in terms of the substance, I don't think the government is disputing that the two aspects, the foreseeability and the scope or the in furtherance of jointly undertaken activity, the government isn't arguing that there's a difference in terms of what the government must find before imposing co-conspirator liability. But procedurally, there is a difference, and it's
so
why.
First, let me get that point. Regarding the substantive finding, you say the government, there is an agreement or disagreement or not?
The government doesn't dispute that in terms of making a determination of the restitution, the court must still find that it's ordering the defendant to make restitution for the offense, and the offense in this case being a conspiracy, the court would still have to find those two aspects of conspiracy, that the defendant is only liable for things within the scope of his agreement, alternately phrased as as things within the jointly undertaken criminal activity, and that it's foreseeable. So we don't dispute that the record has to support those two findings, but here there is ample record evidence to support a conclusion that the activity, that the restitution amount was for the co-conspirator check cashing that was a reasonably foreseeable act in furtherance of appellant's jointly undertaken criminal activity. And that's for...
Goes to foreseeability.
Well, you have to...
The issue that's been raised by Ms. Davis is scope.
The court had ample record evidence to find the scope. First, there was the passage...
Did it make a finding?
I think it can be said that the court made a finding. It didn't make express...
But would it be true?
It didn't make express and detailed factual findings of the nature contemplated in Tabron. It itself state on the record or in a written decision, I specifically find the scope was such and such. But it did clearly address the scope at sentencing, and you can see this in two ways. One is that at page 31 of the transcript, the court clearly states the standard. What are the reasonably foreseeable acts in furtherance of jointly undertaken criminal activity? And there were two ways in which...
That's the statement of the standard for foreseeability. What about for scope?
In furtherance of jointly undertaking criminal activity is the passage that refers to scope.
Okay. Give me the page again, I'm sorry.
That's page 31 of the transcript. And that's actually that same phrase, the in furtherance of jointly undertaking criminal activity, is referred to in the sentencing guidelines, in the case law here, Tabron and the others that address the two factors. But here the court did address the scope in two ways. First, it didn't order restitution for that full $1.6 million of the larger conspiracy, and instead focused on what it termed a small part percentage-wise of the whole conspiracy related to the Coleman and Matthews account, and that's what it said at page 31.
Can I stop you there? I'm concerned about how the Matthews account comes in. Why there was no discussion of that. The judge thought... originally, it's all the account that was opened in his name, and then the prosecutor says, no, actually some of it's the Matthews account, and then it just peters out from there. There's no discussion of why the defendant is responsible for the amount that went into the Matthews account. Can you explain that?
Well, in the pre-sentence report, there's a Maryland plea proffer set forth, and the district court adopted as findings of fact that portion of the pre-sentence report, in fact, the whole pre-sentence report, and that made clear that appellant's, quote, theft scheme involving the counterfeiting of checks, and I think this is page 10 of the PSR, involved using the personal information of Sherry Ann Matthews at Provident Bank in Maryland to obtain a credit good service, and the district court could reasonably infer that that related to the Sherry Ann Matthews account, because on page 61 of the statement of offense, it describes his co-conspirator, Glay, opening an account in the name of Sherry Ann Matthews.
We're connecting a few dots there, though. The judge didn't actually do what you just said, right?
And that's why I made the point earlier that the judge did not make express findings, factual findings, about this being within the scope. But it is a reasonable inference from the record in light of two things. One, the statement of offense, which has these two paragraphs. Appellant agrees both to cashing his own checks and to opening an account to facilitate Glay in cashing separate checks. But also would also direct the court to the indictment, which lays out, I believe, at page 821 and 22 of the record, indictment paragraph 20.B.3, lays out how the conspiracy worked, that these two accounts, the Matthews and Coleman accounts, were used in tandem or in parallel, and also used jointly to launder money. And in fact, the facts—
They're used in tandem and parallel by Glay.
By the—
Not necessarily by Coleman.
Well, Coleman did participate in laundering money from the Matthews account into the Coleman account, and that's set forth in the statement of offense where there are two checks.
Two checks there, but that's not the we have no idea what.
The charge is bank fraud, right? It's not laundering.
No, that's correct, but it shows that since he was cashing those two checks from the Matthews account, it shows that he was aware of that account, and as I said in the Maryland plea proffer adopted as part of the findings of fact, he agreed that he used that account as part of the, quote, theft scheme involving the counterfeiting. Yeah,
I thought when Ms. Davis said there was nothing in the record suggesting that Coleman knew anything about Matthews or her account, that there really was something in the Maryland case. And you're saying there was.
I respectfully disagree with Ms. Davis because at page 10 of the PSR, again, adopted as findings of fact, it talks about using the personal information of Sherry Ann Matthews at Provident Bank, and in the statement of offense, it describes Glay opening an account in the name of co-conspirator Sherry Ann Matthews. So appellant agreed she was a co-conspirator, and it's more than just
that's in this case. And what about in the disposition of the Maryland case? Was there more?
In the Maryland case, and the plea proffer in the Maryland case is set forth on page 10 of the PSR, adopted as findings by the district court. It describes using her personal information at Provident Bank to gain a credit good service, etc. And the district court could reasonably infer that referred to the parallel Matthews account based on the statement of offense and based on the indictment. This conclusion is buttressed by the fact that the appellant argued that the Maryland case was relevant conduct that he should get credit for. So it wasn't some surprise that the Maryland case and the Matthews came up at sentencing.
And this is presumably why the defendant never made a separate argument based solely on the Matthews account.
I'm not sure I understand.
I'm asking what I think is a helpful question for you, which is that the defendant at sentencing never said, okay, even if you count the Coleman account, you shouldn't count the Matthews account. The reason they probably didn't raise that is because it was all tied up in the Maryland case, I assume. I'm going to ask Ms. Davis about that.
I think that's a fair point, and it goes to how the appellant did the same thing with respect to this passage in the statement of offense, which described why he gave his information to Glay to open the account in his name. He wanted to sort of fudge it, and he argued at sentencing that was a gray area and it wasn't crystal clear he knew. So when they got into trouble of confronting the facts that show his agreement as to the scope, they switched over at sentencing and here on appeal to making a foreseeability argument. Well, it wasn't crystal clear he knew absolutely what was going on.
But it's in response to that that the judge makes the statement to which he referred us at 31, right? He says, what I look to is section 1B1.3A.1b of the guidelines, and though I understand the defendant's position, I don't agree that the standard that I heard articulated, I don't agree with the standard that I heard articulated, and that is a not crystal clear standard. He takes issue with that. He disagrees with that. But then he goes on, he says, it doesn't have to be crystal clear. But the next sentence is the one that you pointed to. He says, what we're talking about is what are the reasonably foreseeable acts in furtherance of jointly undertaken criminal activity. Okay? So he's just reciting the standard. He's not saying anything. He's not making any finding here. He's not saying or even implying what's in and what's out of the agreement.
Well, and that's why I say the judge did not make the express findings of the sort contemplated if this was a case controlled by Tabron. But he did impliedly make the finding because he focused on the Coleman and Matthews accounts and only the amounts that moved through those two accounts. And that's again.
Do you think it'd be helpful if he clarified what he thinks was the scope of the agreement?
It would be helpful, but the government's position is that the issue here is whether the record is sufficient to support the restitution order.
I don't think you're taking a position expressly on this, but the Restitution Act on its face speaks of loss caused by the conduct, the criminal conduct. And that suggests that it could require restitution of a sum well beyond the foreseeable element by a particular defendant.
Well, the government isn't arguing that it could go beyond that, and I guess what the government would...
Well, the $1.6 million would have.
Had the court done that, I think we would have a very serious issue here.
Well, you didn't pursue it. You didn't seek the $1.6
million. No, the government did not seek that, and that's why I say that both the government and the district court were focused on limiting the scope of the agreement to that part of the conspiracy that Mr. Coleman joined.
You didn't want to go for the $1.6 million because... He didn't sign on for 8 years worth of conspiracy and so on, right?
That's correct. And the other way...
So you wanted to go for implicitly you are agreeing that there had to be something on scope of agreement.
that there had to be a record adequate to support that this was both within the scope and foreseeable. And the way I would get there is to direct the court to 18 U.S.C. 3663A sub A1, which talks about that the court shall order that the defendant make restitution to the victim of the offense. And so the restitution is still limited in the MVRA by the offense, and so you have to define what the scope of the offense, in this case being a conspiracy, what the scope and foreseeability of that conspiracy was.
Which could be the whole 1.6 million.
Well, if it was within the scope to which this defendant agreed and foreseeable to, but here we're not arguing.
That's not in the MVRA, right? You're saying, well, maybe you are saying it's imported through the reference to the offense being you're reading that as the offense of this defendant's conviction.
That's correct. There is a limiting principle in the MVRA. It's not, you touch the conspiracy, you're liable for the entire thing.
Right, which would be problematic.
That would be, Your Honor.
To pick up on Judge Ginsburg's question, wouldn't it be helpful to send this back so that we could obtain clarification on why the Matthews account comes in?
It arguably could be helpful, but it's not necessary because there is ample record evidence to support the conclusion that the Matthews account should be included. We discussed before the Maryland plea proffer, the statement in the statement of offense that refers to the co-conspirator Sherry Ann Matthews account. And this conclusion is also buttressed, as you pointed out, by appellant arguing at sentencing that the Matthews and the Maryland case should be included as part of the relevant conduct. So there's no need to send it back for further proceedings when there's ample record evidence already to support the restitution order. The last point I would make is that under tape, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, you've used your time. I wonder if there are further questions. Is your last point one sentence?
My last point, Your Honor, is that if there being no further questions, the government would ask that the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Page 122 of the joint appendix, it was argued by counsel for Mr. Coleman. It's page 29 of the sentencing transcript. And based on the information, as we understand it, we do not believe that the scope of his agreement encompassed all the activity that needs to go into the $157,000 calculation. So I think it was raised both in the sentencing memorandum and also at sentencing itself.
And doesn't the judge then come back and say the sentence that the government points to, what we're talking about is what are the reasonably foreseeable acts in furtherance of the jointly undertaken criminal activity.
Right, exactly. So the judge is reading the standard, you know what the guidelines language is, but then the judge goes on to say, I think it was reasonably foreseeable. He doesn't discuss scope. He only discusses foreseeability. So there was no discussion of scope by the judge. And regarding the Maryland case, and this is why I filed a motion to supplement the appendix with the papers from the Maryland case. The overlap in the Maryland case had nothing to do with the Sherry Matthews account. It had to do with a sport and health check that was that Mr. Coleman pled guilty to in Maryland and was also part of the agreement in the D.C. case. As far as Mr. Coleman's involvement with the Matthews account in Maryland, the paperwork from the Maryland case said that the three defendants committed identity theft and they possessed the personal information of Sherry Ann Matthews without her consent. According to the Maryland case, Matthews was a victim of Mr. Coleman, not a co-conspirator. And so that's why I asked that this court consider the paperwork from the Maryland case to show what the overlap is. And it was not the Matthews account, it was a sport and health check.
And this all goes to the restitution, right? Not because the sentence was time served?
Bottom line, it goes to the restitution, yes.
Ms. Davis, at 122 of the JA, where you started us here, we do not believe the scope of his agreement encompassed all the activity that needs to go into the $157,000 calculation.
Right.
Involvement was 3 months, limited to receiving checks and taking a small percentage. So at that point, what were you saying the scope of agreement did cover? Was it just the $55,000?
Just the $55,000, yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hooks. Case is submitted.